You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
With 2026 marking the 50th anniversary of the first ever Winter Paralympic Games held in Sweden in February 1976, with teams of blind and partially sighted athletes competing in both alpine and Nordic skiing, and for many it was their first time on snow too. Here on RNIB Connect Radio, we thought it would be a good time to look back on that very first Winter Paralympic Games and find out what it was like taking part in the Games for the very first time as a visually impaired athlete, as well as having a look back at how the Games have evolved and grown over the last 50 years. I'm delighted to say that I am now joined by Mike Brace, CBE, DL, who was there at that very first Winter Paralympic Games, representing Great Britain for the first time in the Games too. Hello, Mike, and thanks for joining me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Great pleasure. Great pleasure.
So, firstly, Mike, how did the opportunity come about to compete as a blind person in that very first Winter Paralympic Games back in Sweden in 1976?
And it was quite strange, really. In 1973, myself and seven friends got together in a pub and formed the Metro Sports Club. And that was, you know, really quite innovatory, because there was very little to do outside the school system in terms of sport. So Metro got formed. And the second year, in 74, we got an invitation from someone in Norway saying that they have got this ski week for the blind. Would we like to send people over to attend it? And I must admit, I was apprehensive and pretty skeptical about blind people skiing. So I circulated it round to the growing membership and was really surprised when about a dozen, 14, said, yes, we'd love to go. So having them all saying they wanted to go, I thought, well, I can't let them go without me. So my wife and I then signed up, went over and absolutely loved it. And so we just thought this was absolutely fantastic. Booked to go the following year and enjoyed it. And just as we'd been, I think, the second time, they announced that, they were going to hold the first Winter Paralympics. And for the first time in both the Winter and the Summer Olympics, they were going to include blind competitors, blind and partially sighted. So suddenly we were skiers. We'd done 2 weeks on snow. And they said, would you like to trial for selection to go over to Sweden for these games? And three of us in London and two guys from Scotland all got together. We went down to Aldershot and did our trial and had the army sort of supervising us and got selected. So the five of us then became the team, plus one amputee who was going to ski on the alpine bits of it. And suddenly we then found ourselves as the six people representing Britain at the first Paralympic Winter Games, but also the first Games ever to include blind and partially sighted competitors.
And what was it like for the whole team, I suppose, getting out on your Nordic skis for that first time and almost gliding along on the snow?
Well, it was a bit more complicated than that, because in those days, obviously, there was no actual Paralympic Association in the UK. So we were out there really organised and supported by the Ski Club for the Disabled that we'd set up in 74, 75 to cover winter sports. And then when we got out there, obviously we had really poor equipment. We had tracksuits that really weren't suitable for the conditions, because you sweat quite a lot in cross country, but these suits didn't allow you to sweat properly. So you were, you know, almost like a jungle fresh peanut, you know, you were absolutely glowing. And then we got introduced to guides for the first time, two of which didn't speak English, which obviously was another barrier when you're trying to race with someone. So there were lots and lots of, if you like, difficult conditions, but it was just still fantastic, because you were out there, you were representing a country, no Olympic Village or Paralympic Village. You were in a bed and breakfast, which we got locked out of because we got back after 9 o'clock one evening. And luckily, the cameraman that was with us, he shot up the drain pipe and let us in through the bathroom window. So it was very, very basic, but still an incredible, incredible thrill to be there as the first blind to represent Britain in the Paralympics and also in the Winter Games.
And there was that wonderful Thames Television documentary that was following you all during your training as you were all preparing to get out to the very first Winter Paralympic Games and following you during the Games as well. And it did look that you were very much being put through your paces through your training as well.
Very much so. I mean, the army obviously had sort of links. A lot of them had been in the army ski teams and through the Marines. So we did have some contacts then in Norway at a training camp that we could use that was previously run by army colonels and majors, etc. And then down at Aldershot, they really did put us through our paces in the fitness. Because in those days, down in Aldershot, they actually had a plastic cross-country ski track. So it was the only place in England that we could go and train. So we would go down to Aldershot on a regular basis and go on this plastic ski slope going round and round, about a quarter of a mile around on this track, and then do the aerobic training, you know, on the area around it with the army.
And it was interesting in that documentary to hear some of the things that you were all experiencing at that time as young visually impaired people and thinking about. And, you know, it's just interesting, I suppose, looking back to think that some of those things that you were all talking about at that time have not changed in the last 50 years.
Yeah, I think attitudes, you know, the general thought was, you know, the barriers that were often then placed in front of us, some of which I must admit we probably did put there ourselves. Because, you know, if people tell you you're never going to be able to do something or you shouldn't be doing it, you know, if you've told that often enough, you start to believe it. So we had real areas of lack of confidence that, you know, we were sort of breaking new ground, but at the same time, you know, really excited by it, but then having to try and find ways of learning to ski properly, the techniques, getting guides that could explain it to us properly, could then keep up with us when we got better at it, and all of those things. And then the attitudes of, you know, the Paralympics obviously were, I would say, barely known in those days, either summer or the winter. And therefore, a lot of it, you were self-funding. We had to do various mad schemes to raise the money to get out there because you were self-funding, and then trying to find better ways of training. But the attitudes generally were, you know, why are you doing this? You're pretty mad. And again, the cost side of it, with so many people out of work, luckily, the three of us in the London area all had jobs. One was a piano tuner, one worked in an office, and I was doing my social work training. So, you know, so the three of us actually were in a position, you know, with a bit of money, which is unlike so many other vision impaired people still to this day, with 80% unemployed.
Yeah, no, that figure hasn't really changed over the last 50 years as well.
And
I think, you know, so as I said, you know, some of the things that you were talking about in that documentary, the three of you, about attitudes and about, you know, sort of work and everything else, as I say, hasn't really changed, which is quite incredible to think.
And of course, I suppose the advent of technology now has had some effect, but even then, you know, the bits that were coming forward really didn't enable to be able to publicise or to find out information then. And at times that's still the same now. You don't know where to look for the information, even though the webs are there and all the IT stuff. But at times you still don't have a clue where to get a particular piece of information.
And coming back to the Games itself, were there crowds there in Sweden in 1976?
Very limited. I think it was mainly the army and you know, people involved in organising the games. We certainly didn't have like family members or others coming over to support us. We had two people, an elderly couple, that were really our only support mechanism. And in the digs, for instance, the three of us were three totally blind in one room, had two partially sighted in another room, and the amputee guy And that those three then ended up really being guides for the three totally blind athletes.
And of course, we've obviously had the great coverage of both the Winter and Summer Games over the years. And I wondered back then, was there much about, I suppose, encouraging blind and partially sighted people to get into sport? Because I think now we can certainly see that the Games have a legacy. But I wondered back then in 1976, was there much about encouraging people to get into sport?
No. I mean the coverage was largely a documentary shown a week after the Games. So there was no notice or people wouldn't know that the Games were actually happening until, you know, the documentary came out a week later and said, you know, these are the wonderful Games and aren't they marvellous type things. So the attitude was still very much about disability first and overcoming adversity as opposed to sporting athletes who happen to be disabled. So it was still that sort of focus on the disability rather than the ability. And, you know, the week's trip that we started to organise to Norway every year since then, I mean, we're still going now 40, 50 years later, that is the main introduction that many people have to try, skiing now. And it's broader now. It's alpine, it's snowboarding, it's cross country as well. And the numbers are gradually going up and up and up because it is, you know, one of the single opportunities still available to try something like that.
Mike, as well as competing, you manage the cross-country team from 1988 until 1994. And for the 1998 Winter Paralympic Games, you were appointed as chef de mission for the Great British team, as well as being a director of Paralympics GB. And of course, not to mention being involved in bringing the Summer Olympic and Paralympic Games to London in 2012. Mike, from your viewpoint over the last 50 years, as an athlete and as being there behind the scenes, have you seen the Games sort of, I suppose, develop and evolve, and also the encouragement of getting more blind and partially sighted people in the Games?
I think the evolution has been quite dramatic. I attended in one form or another, as you mentioned, 9 Winter Games from 76 to 98, which was my last as a sort of a manager. And then I went into 2002 and 2006 as chef de mission again. And it was an evolution in terms of the game side of it. So we had really good medical support for the first time built into the Games as they evolved. So in the early days, we didn't have any physiotherapy. We didn't have any doctors. And essentially, those have all been added to in terms of the team support. The equipment then was pretty basic. And luckily, I met up with a Norwegian who was acting as my guide in 1977 at the Beiterstølen week. And then basically that was really quite fantastic because he was a quite a prominent businessman in Scandinavia. So we started to get funding. He arranged then Norwegian guides who were competent at skiing, but also communicating that. So we had better coaching, better training right the way through then to all the different structures started to evolve. And I think it took a while in those early days because the Games were largely evolved around the different disability groups. So although they were the Paralympics for, you know, for all disabilities or growing number of disabilities, the process, the support mechanisms really for both the Winter and the Summer Games was still back into the disability groups. So I was involved with setting up British Blind Sport in 1975. And then as such, with the Ski Club for the Disabled also then being formed, what we then had was largely us sorting out the blind representation and the Wheelchair Sports Association sorting out the wheelchair representation, and BLASMA, the limbless amputee group, sorting out. And then the only time you met really was at the event. So that all changed. I mean, I went to the current team's kit allocation and get together in the middle of February, and it was just amazing. You had all the support staff, you had the briefings, you had the protocols around media. You know, it was just unbelievably different from 50 years ago. And that was quite reassuring to see that whole progress, because it paralleled on the back of the Summer Games, which had more profile, more coverage. And certainly, obviously, 2012 really highlighted our sport's opportunities to the full. I mean, with live coverage for the first time that we had in 2012, suddenly, you know, not only did, you know, people with disabilities see what was happening in terms of the sport, but it prompted them, many of whom hadn't really realised that those opportunities were there. That was a big, big push in the UK, because when I lost my sight age 10, you went to special schools and that's where your main sporting input came. Now with, you know, 90% of kids with disabilities in mainstream schools, the sporting opportunities are largely the ones lost to them. They you know, they can't join in team games in their schools because of, you know, the ball's different or whatever. And so more and more opportunities need to be made so that these kids, you know, can get those opportunities. And showing the Paralympics in 2012 has really snowballed the awareness. You know, the kids that saw 2012, saw these images of people like themselves doing the sport, really prompted a massive increase in that level of awareness. I think after 2012, we had some have-a-go days to try and get more kids with disabilities interested in sport. And we hoped that we would get 150 to turn up and try the different sports. And the first one we held in the Midlands, 1,100 kids turned up. And that was their first opportunities to try, whether it be blind sports like goalball or judo or, you know, the other ones, wheelchair, basketball or whatever. It was an incredible, because they just hadn't seen them in their experience, because the schools didn't do it, and where else would they have seen it?
And I suppose also the games have become much more accessible over the years, not only for competitors but also for spectators as well, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, London Paralympic spectatorship, I think, will probably never be equaled. It's still regarded in the Paralympic movement as the first real games where they were a sporting event that happened to be done by people with a disability as opposed to a disabled sporting event. And when I was in Beijing, for instance, in 2008, in 10 days in the athletic stadium, they bussed in and had roughly over the 10 days about 150,000, 160,000 spectators, it was estimated. In one day at the stadium in London, we had over 150,000 in one day. So yeah, it was just an incredible awakening, really, of what was around. You've now got many ex-disabled sports people now featuring on the media, on the television, on the commentaries. And so you've suddenly got a whole new ball game. Channel 4, obviously, their live coverage. They'll be covering more of the 2026 games as well. So again, you've got this profile of these sports and the disabled people that are doing them.
We have had some great achievements from great British visually impaired skiers over the years, with Kelly Gallagher, MBE, winning the first Winter Paralympic gold medal for Great Britain, which was at the Games in 2014, and not forgetting all the medals that Mena Fitzpatrick has won over the years, becoming Great Britain's most decorated Winter Paralympian at the 2018 Games, and 4 years later at the Beijing Games in 2022. Mena became the most decorated Winter Paralympian in history too. So it does show that with the right support and opportunities, that visually impaired athletes can achieve so much in sport, can't they?
Very much so. And And I'm particularly proud as well, because the first medals that we won in snow sport were actually done by two blind competitors. So in the 92 or 94 games, Richard Burt became the first person to win a medal in alpine skiing, and he was a vision impaired athlete. And Peter Young became the first person to win a medal in the cross country skiing, and so they became the first bronze medal winners in the Paralympics that we'd had. And then there was Johnny Watson in the 94 games. He was a arm amputee, so he became the third person to win a medal. And that set it moving forward, and obviously celebrating the Kelly and Mel, you know, that was incredible performances and something really to be celebrated, as long as we keep that focus in terms of saying this is what's possible.
Finally, Mike, what do you see, I suppose, the main legacy of the Winter Paralympic Games as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Winter Paralympic Games this year?
I think it's putting winter sports as a viable option for people to choose to have a go and enjoy it. As we said, the Bartestolen week that we've been a part of organising, you know, that's had 20, 30 people going over the period of time, mainly vision impaired, but not only. We've had sit skiers, we've had people with learning disabilities and amputees going as well, but largely still vision impaired. And this year, we've now got 50 plus wanting to go. So suddenly you've got the knowledge of what's available, you've got an opportunity to try something for the first time. And that's really cottoned on to a lot of people's mentality that, you know, that I've never really thought about that, but I apparently can have a go at snowboarding. I can have now a go at alpine or cross country or snowshoeing or whatever it is, and have that experience that other people have had. So, you know, I think those opportunities, you know, may be still fairly scarce, but basically are available, and more people are taking themselves, you know, into those settings to have a go at it. Doesn't really matter that they're not going on then to think about, you know, competitive and Paralympics necessarily. I mean, you know, some of the technology and technical issues have changed quite massively in the games. So we haven't had a blind competitor from the UK in cross country since 1998, mainly because the techniques have changed. So they introduced freestyle skiing, for instance, which would be incredibly difficult for someone over here without snow, you know, able to practice on, to suddenly be able to learn and then get good enough then to represent at a competitive level. Whereas the alpine now, you know, there are lots of opportunities for them to go abroad and get good coaching. And that's why they've gone into the ascendancy in terms of, you know, really big success in the men's and women's alpine, but fewer and fewer people in the cross-country areas.
Well, thank you so much indeed, Mike, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and giving me a great insight into what it was like taking part as a visually impaired athlete in that very first Winter Paralympic Games in Sweden in 1976, and for a look back over the years of the Winter Paralympic Games as we celebrate the 50th anniversary this year.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed for inviting me.
For more interviews, features and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.